أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله
to another episode of Psalm in Focus. We're continuing with our series dealing with the sources of Islam. Today we have our fourth segment dealing with the topic of the Quran and modern sciences. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum. I wonder if I could have you very quickly summarize the main points that we touched on in our last segment dealing with this very interesting and fascinating topic of the Quran and modern sciences.
Thank you. Well, we tried to expose or, you know, share some of the information in the Quran about certain aspects pertaining to scientific discoveries, if you will, something that was known only for hundreds of years after the Quran was revealed, including things like the interstellar galactic material, the meaning of the day, and that the Quran says a day could be like 50,000 years, so it doesn't mean that the heavens and earth were created in 6 days by 24 hours. We talked also about the sequence of creation, and he said that there's no conclusive evidence of one preceding the other, and there's a good possibility, the way the Quran expressed it, of a sort of interlocking stages in the development of earth alongside with the development of other heavenly bodies. We talked a little bit also about the balance of all of these various elements in the universe and the divine order behind them, and how the Quran also specifies this fact. A little bit of discussion about the expansion of the universe, which is a relatively recent type of theory, which has some hint about it in the Quran, or appears to have that hint. The reason why the Quran speaks about heavens and gives the number 7, that it doesn't mean necessarily numerical, but it means also numerous. And the last question dealt with the constant motion and movement of heavenly bodies, and quoted, for example, two passages in the Quran in which it says that the various heavenly bodies are actually swimming along in their orbit. And the question there was, how could anyone at the 7th century, with the kind of environment in which Prophet Muhammad was raised, learn about these things unless it's coming from some other source? And we said that the reasonable conclusion here is that this is a revelation, actually, divine revelation.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the concluding passages that we cited in last week's program and then touched on again today in your summary, the very interesting concept or term, swim along, was used. Mm-hmm. Is there any particular reason why this concept was used, or these words were used, swim along?
I believe there is. In fact, one of the scholars, the students of the Quran, Sheikh Muhammad Sha'rawi, Muhammad Tawalli Sha'rawi, he made a very nice reflection on the term used here. That's his specialty, actually, and an analysis of the terms and why one term used rather than a very similar term that might give a different indication. And before even getting to Sheikh Sha'rawi, perhaps I could make a comment here that kind of expression was puzzling also to commentators in the Quran, as we have seen in the previous program. Nobody could imagine, for example, that the heavenly bodies float or swim or move. And Dr. Bouquet in the Bible, Quran and Science quotes a very famous commentator on the Quran by the name of At-Tabari from the 10th century in the Christian era. While he explaining or commenting on verses like this or passages like this in the Quran, he said that it is our duty to keep silent when we don't know. Mm-hmm. In other words, it was puzzling thing. He could not give an explanation. He said, right, we don't know.
Yeah.
But that shows again that something was unclear within the level of their understanding about what the meaning of the passage swimming along. But the interesting explanation that Sheikh Shahrawi gives to this is that he says that when you talk about swimming, for example, when you swim, it means that nothing is moving you. You are moving yourself. So it's internally generated mm-hmm. movement from within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And he says if you really think about the rotation of these heavenly bodies, it's not that something is turning it. Of course, gravitational forces could be a factor and all that. But essentially, it is internal movement. In other words, the heavenly bodies are moving. Nothing is moving them. No artificial power, for example, mm-hmm. is moving them. The second reflection on it also is that the term swimming along, if you're a good swimmer, you know how a good swimmer mm-hmm. actually floats in a smooth type of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a beautiful analogy, again, of what we know of the nature of the rotation, smooth rotation of those heavenly bodies. And that is quite different, for example, from the Quranic expression of motion as it relates to mountains, as will probably come or arise a little later when we deal with the earth itself and the motion of the earth. The expression is different, and for very good reason, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. With respect to the mention of the sun and the moon, does the Quran mention anything about the differences in their light-giving characteristics?
Yes, there is. In the entire Quran, there was not a single occasion that the sun was described, for example, in the Arabic term nur, which means light, which could possibly mean the reflection of light. Always the Quran refers to the sun as siraj, or sirajan wahajan, which means a source of light. Siraj means something that is not just reflecting light, it means also a source of that light. We find that, for example, in the Quran in 10 5 and in 78:13. By the same token, whenever the Quran speaks about the moon, not once was the moon referred to in the same term that was used to describe the sun. In other words, nowhere in the Quran does it say that the moon is siraj, which could give the indication that it is a source of light. Always the moon is referred to as nuran, light. Mm-hmm. Which could mean also a reflection of light, but cannot mean at all, at least in that context, a source mm-hmm. of that light. Additional differences to this kind of distinction beside the two passages mentioned include, for example, 25:61 and 71:16. Now, it is very interesting here, at least for comparative purpose, is that when you compare the notion, for example, in the book of Genesis about the sun and the moon, you find that both of them were described as light. One is a major light, that's the sun, the other is a lesser light, and that is the moon. The Quran, unlike the expression in Genesis, makes that very delicate distinction between the sun and the moon, which obviously means that the moon does not have light of its own, does not generate that light, but simply it's a reflection of the siraj, of the source of light that comes to it, which is the sun. And again, the very basic question we're asking throughout this series, how could Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the 7th century, unlettered, in an uneducated environment, in a world which didn't have a notion about that, and all this was that there is light in the moon, and nobody really could understand this kind of reflection until hundreds of years later. And how could he have obtained that knowledge? And if it were true, like some writers claim, that he copied from other previous scriptures or sources, how come that this information is not there?
Mm-hmm.
It is only in the Quran.
Mm-hmm. Now, if the moon is simply, if it simply reflects the light received from the sun, does that mean that if the sun cools off like the earth did,
mm-hmm.
that life on earth will be destroyed?
It would be catastrophic, but of course I don't want to give the indication or impression to anyone that catastrophe is imminent. Of course, if God wanted to happen at any time, it could happen without the following of the natural laws that we understand it, but at least as far as scientific information about it, yes, it would, because what's happening now is that the sun is in a constant process, since it started actually, from the in the process of transforming hydrogen atom into helium. When that transformation is completed, it would automatically mean that the sun would cool off. And finally, its light, of course, will greatly diminish. The density will increase, and it will be just like a dead star, like other stars that died before the sun. But as I said earlier, there is no reason for alarm, because that process of transformation would probably take another maybe 5.5 more billion years. But there's something fascinating here about the destiny of the sun, which is mentioned also in the Quran, or hinted to in the Quran. It says, وَالشَّمْسُ تَجْرِي لِمُسْتَقَرٍ لَهَا ذَلِكَ تَقْدِيرُ الْعَزِيزِ الْعَلِيمِ. That's in Surah 36. That the sun runs its course for a period determined, or a settled place. It could be translated both ways. This is the decree of the Almighty, the Full of Knowledge. The original Arabic word that talks about the destiny of the sun, or final resting place, if you translate it literally, is the word mustaqar. And mustaqar could mean, as Dr. Bukay explains, could mean place-wise, or it could also mean time-wise, that there is a certain determined period. That is when that transformation is finished, as we understand it now, the sun is finished, or at least as we know it today, will be over.
Well, I'm sure our viewers are pleased to learn that we're not going to lose the sun any time in the near future. Seeing as I was going to be around for a little while, I'd like to look at another related aspect, and that has to do with the question of the day and night cycle. What does the Quran say about the day and night cycle?
Well, this is another interesting area also. Let me first start by citing some of the quotations from the Quran, which has some bearing on this question. In 754, يُغْشِ اللَّيْلَ النَّهَارَ يَطْلُبُهُ حَثِيثًا. That says, Allah covers the day with the night, which is in haste to follow it. Constant cycle of day and night. In 36:37, وَآيَةٌ لَهُمُ اللَّيْلُ نَسْلَخُ مِنْهُ النَّهَارُ. That is, and a sign unto them, a sign unto mankind, a sign that means of God's omnipotence, power, and mercy, is the night. We strip it of the day, and they are in darkness. In 31:29, يُولِجُ اللَّيْلَ فِي النَّهَارِ. That, has you not seen that Allah merges, notice the term, and we'll come to that later. Allah merges the night into the day, and the day into the night. And notice this one in 39:5. يُكَوِّرُ اللَّيْلَ عَلَى النَّهَارِ. It is He that Allah, He winds the night upon the day, and coils the day upon the night. The term here of used to refer to this coiling or winding is what scientists basically call interpenetration. That is to say, the earth, as we know, is turning around its own axis, alright?
Mm-hmm.
Which means that half of the sphere of the earth makes one revolution around the earth in 24 hours, okay? While the other half remains in darkness. Alright? So in other words, there is a hint there in terms of this coiling or winding of the existence of the day and night simultaneously, depending of course on the position of the earth vis-a-vis the sun. The original Arabic word which was translated as coiling, actually yukawwir, come from the Arabic word kura, which means a ball. Which is again a very, very early mention of the shape of the earth as a sphere. Alright? Now, when you compare, for example, the Bible and Quran with respect to the earth and day and night, As you might recall, in one previous program, it was indicated that the Bible says that in the first day of creation, the night and day were created. Whereas with our understanding now that the day and night actually on earth are a phenomenon that only emerged after the creation of the sun, whereas the Genesis says that the sun or the firmaments were created later on after the day and night has been created. You don't find this difficulty at all with the Quran at all in terms of compatibility with what we know in science today. A similar expression also that shows that it was not just a casual or unique or peculiar passage in the Quran. In 36:40, for example, it says, لَالشَّمْسُ يَنْبَغِي لَهَا أَن تُدْرِكَ الْقَمَرِ, that is the one that we cited before, the night cannot outstrip the day, and the day cannot outstrip the night. And all of these references obviously give a clear indication of the constant motion of the earth. And this is, by the way, not the only evidence in the Quran of the rotation of the earth.
Mm-hmm. These are very interesting points. I wonder if perhaps I could have you to expand on it a little bit further and give us some more references.
Even about the question of rotation of the,
yes,
of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is one particular citation in the Quran which many scholars, including Bouquet and Sheikh Shahrawi and others, have really made a very nice commentary on. And it's amazing, really. In Surah 27, in passage 88, it says, وَتَرَى الْجِبَالَ تَحْسَبُهَا جَامِدَةً وَهِيَ تَمُرُّ مَرَّ السَّحَابِ, that is, you see the mountains, that's when you look at them, and you think that they are firmly fixed, i.e. stationary. And, in fact, it passes away as the cloud pass away. Such is the handiwork of Allah, who disposes of all things in perfect order. Now, first question here. What does the Quran mean by saying that the mountains, while appearing to us as stationary, in fact, move? Unless this is actually a reference to the movement of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
See the point?
Mm-hmm.
You think it's stationary, but it's actually moving. But we know that the mountains do not move on their own. There's nothing that's that provide them with this self-generated motion, which means that it is moving how? It's moving along with the
rotation
of the earth. That's one thing. But there is another equally interesting commentary about the meticulous accuracy and sober language used in the Quran when it deals with scientific aspects, free from any myth that was predominant in the days of the Prophet or even after him. And that it describes the motion of the mountains and make an analogy between that and the motion or movement of the clouds. Remember in the previous program when we were talking about the sun and moon swimming along,
yes,
right? And he said that this is different from the expression that the Quran describes about the motion of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Why did the Quran say that the mountains pass like clouds rather than pass like animals move or some other things? It means that the motion is not coming from the mountain itself, because the cloud does not move by itself. We all know that.
Mm-hmm.
The motion that you see in the cloud is because of what? The wind.
Right.
The wind is moving it. So again, the mountains, since they do not move by themselves, they are moving just like the cloud. They are driven by some other force, which is actually the rotation of the earth. How could this meticulous description be given 1400 years ago, unless it has a different source, a non-human source?
Mm-hmm. Well, another aspect which is related to the day-night cycle is the question of determination of direction.
Mm-hmm.
When the Quran refers to the east and the west, what does that mean? Normally we think of the east or west, but not the east and west.
You mean in plural?
Yes.
In fact, there is a third expression also used in the Quran. In some cases, it speaks about Allah being the Lord of east and west in the singular. which of course means the simple meaning that anyone can relate to or understand, mm-hmm. East and West. For example, you find that in 2.116 and 2.142, in 2.177 and 25, there are numerous citations like that in the Quran. In some cases, it is even describes the East and West in two, like two Easts, the Lord of the two Easts and two Wests. Like, for example, in 55:17. And still, like you indicated, there are also citations in the Quran speaking about Easts and Wests in plural, numerous. The difficulty arises here with respect to the two and numerous. Numerous is easy. If you really watch the sunrise and sunset in different seasons, you will notice that the sun does not always rise, at least as you see it, from the same spot and sets in the same spot. So with the change of seasons, you don't only have one east and one west, but you have several points from which the sun rises and several points to which the sun sets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, how about the expression, Lord of the two Easts and two Wests? There have been some explanations given to that. Some people, for example, said that when it talks about two Easts and two Wests, or two sunrises and two sunsets, or two rises and two sets, if you will, it is quite possible that this may be a reference to sunrise and sunset, moonrise and moonset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Other people said that could it possibly be referring to the basic change in seasons between winter and summer? So we're talking about the two points from which the sun rises from in winter and summer, and the two points again of sunset. There could be other explanation, reversal of the axis of the earth. Only Allah knows. There are some scientists also speak about, you know, some of these possible things to happen in terms of reversal of the poles, for example. Mm-hmm. However, this is an area that I don't think that anyone really can give the final answer on that. But one east and one west, we understand it. Easts and wests in plural, it is understandable. But the two east and two west, we may have some luck in our interpretation. We could be wrong, and maybe days might too. But the point again still remains. Neither of these expressions can be proven to be incorrect, quote unquote, from the scientific standpoint.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to wait for further developments. Maybe it will be like the early interpreters of the Quran who didn't understand the full meaning at one particular point in time, but later, in the light of other discoveries, the meaning became more clear.
Exactly. They said this is what we understand so far now.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe some other generations may be able to see more into it.
Well, in recent times, we've spent an awful lot of money in space exploration, and
right.
I'm sure there are many people who are watching the program who would like to know whether or not the Quran has anything to say with respect to this, whether or not there may be other planets like our Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any answer to this question in the Quran?
Well, let me start first with the Quran. And you will notice that in the very first surah in the Quran, it says, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Praise be to Allah, or God, capital G, Lord of the worlds in plural.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't, for example, use the term universe, even though universe in a sense could mean also worlds, but it uses the plural of alam, world, in plural. Some people in the past, of course, tried to understand that, and some of their interpretation also should be regarded as valid, because they said it could be a reference to the world of human beings and the world of spirits or jinn. I mean, this could be a valid interpretation. It could be the worlds of humans and the world of angels, for example, as other level of existence. However, we find that there are certain expressions in the Quran that are quite explicit in describing heavens in plural, as we described, for example, in the previous program, but also some describe or use the term earth al-aradim. Or the term worlds itself actually means that there could be also other worlds similar to our own world. Now, as far as the state of knowledge we have so far is that most scientists believe that it is highly unlikely that there is any other planet in our solar system which has an atmosphere which is conducive to life. And this has been already been proven partly, for example, by going to the moon, that there's no water, for example, which is a fundamental thing for the beginning of life. But our solar system is not the only one. If you go beyond the solar system, for example, to our galaxy, you're talking really about 10 billion stars, and scientists estimate that half of those stars are rotating, so about 5 billion of them, are rotating also very slowly in a similar fashion to the rotation of the Sun. And they say that this sort of rotation seems to suggest that they are surrounded by planets, that each of these stars is surrounded by other planets, which are the satellites of those stars. But the main problems, the main problem in coming with more conclusive results about this is that these stars are so far away that it is very difficult, if not almost impossible, to make very clear observation of them. But they deducted from what they call the trajectory characteristics of the stars, or the curved path, that there is a possibility that there could be other Earths similar to ours. But this is something that no one can really say for sure, whether there is other Earths with living creatures on it or not.
Mm-hmm. Another fascinating program. Thank you, Brother Jamal. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. Join us next week.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله